You are listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice.
Well, good morning or good afternoon or greetings to wherever you are. It is morning for me in Denver, Colorado, the United States. Again, my name is Abigail Tecker. I am a licensed psychologist in Colorado, but I'm honored today to represent the International Association for Correctional and Forensic Psychology, otherwise known as IACFP. Thank you for the opportunity to share about our association and specifically how it helps support advanced human-centered rehabilitation and that how practice-led learning among psychologists and other behavioral health professionals is shaping future program design across prisons, parole, and in probation community settings. In the next 10 to 15 minutes, I want to give a brief overview of IACFP, who we are, our mission, our strategic direction, followed by some recent highlights from our visit. We did a networking and a board meeting in Oslo, Norway, which included site visits and global learning exchanges. I'd then like to connect these to our broader movement towards human-centered rehabilitation and the critical role of practice-led learning. And of course, we'd like to hear any questions that folks have of me. So who we are? Who is IACFP? I'll make sure that I follow up and that we'll make sure that our website is available as well as our most recent bulletin. But IACFP is a global professional association dedicated to advancing the science and practice of psychology within criminal justice systems. We represent psychologists, psychiatrists, researchers, and frontline behavioral health professionals who work every day to improve outcomes for incarcerated persons, for the correctional leaders and staff working in these systems, and ultimately for the communities they serve. Our association exists for a very focused purpose, helping the helpers. We support the well-being, effectiveness, and professional development of those working in some of the most challenging environments: corrections, community supervision, forensic mental health, and reintegration services. Our mission is rooted in three primary commitments: promoting evidence-informed, humane, and effective correctional practices, connecting research, practice, and policy across diverse global systems, and building strong international community of correctional and forensic psychology professionals. One of the things that I really want to highlight is our focus on practitioner-led learning and support and well-being. It's one of the reasons that once members join us and get engaged, that they find it is most valuable. It is extremely helpful when we are sharing research opportunities and programming that we've recently done, and we're connecting people across the globe. But there's something very unique that happens when you bring psychologists, psychiatrists, behavioral health professionals, and researchers focused in the space together from across the globe, who are doing in many ways very similar work, but also very different work. So as we move into 2026 and beyond, our board has prioritized expanding our global presence even further so that we can make sure that the network sharing is truly a global community of practice. We recently hosted our biannual in-person board meeting, as well as our networking meeting in Oslo. And I'd like to give you a few of our highlights from that trip. Oslo, Norway is a country widely recognized for its commitment to humane correctional practices and human-centered rehabilitation. Our time there included a site visit, definitely a highlight for me, a global learning exchange featuring Norway but other jurisdictions, and networking to elevate peer-based learning and practitioner voice. So our prison visit in Oslo, we had the opportunity to visit a correctional facility in Oslo. Again, our goal is to help psychologists as well as other behavioral health professionals working in justice systems. So it's important when we are visiting countries that we get an opportunity to see those systems and tour them, which we did. And we had the opportunity to meet with leaders and frontline staff. In addition to hearing from them about how they're approaching their philosophy and their daily practices working with individuals convicted of very serious offenses, we also had networking opportunities at lunch breaks and coffee breaks to really hear from frontline staff what's going well, what they're challenged with, and network. What stood out most is how deeply they are committed to that relational security. Their staff professionalism shapes their daily environment. Officers are trained not only as security staff, but as competency builders. people who actively contribute to the individual's long-term reintegration and well-being. The takeaway was simple, but very profound. Rehabilitation is fundamentally relational. The environment matters, staff matter, and hope matters. Also very valuable, after that meeting, we had an opportunity to reconvene outside of the prison setting. It included members and staff from Norway's prison system, but it also included other individuals in our network who presented on their programming, training opportunities, what's going well, and what they're challenged with. Some of the highlights included a presentation about the Irish prison system, both California, Texas, and the United States, and Singapore. And while each region is different, the common thread is clear. Evidence-based models only work and succeed when they're adapted thoughtfully and continuously through practitioner input. One of the things that we had an opportunity to highlight also was peer-based learning. Our networking sessions include reinforcement that we can learn from each other just as much as we can learn from reading research and publications, both within and across countries and conversations. Also showcase the value of intentionally creating space where practice informs what we're doing together and professionals across the world, how we can grow together. I know I personally walked away with takeaways that I could take immediately home and start using. And that brings us back to our central theme for today, is focusing about how ICFP really also wants to focus on human-centered rehabilitation. And human-centered rehabilitation is really about individuals, not cases or diagnoses. It's not about risk scores, but it's about what humans are capable of in their growth. Make no mind, we also at ICFP do believe that there are important values in risk scores, evidence-based programming, but that has to be informed meaningfully with dignity, both with the individuals that we're serving in trauma-informed practices, and as well as hearing from the practitioners in the field around what's working and not working. Research is important, and we want to advance that. It's equally important to implement the research in a real-world setting and hear directly from practitioners about what's going well and what's not going well. The other thing that we like to focus is a strength-based learning approach to foster agency and competency. One of our ways that we do that in collaborative relationships is through our bulletin, and I'll make sure to share that. And one thing that we want to highlight is that while we are growing our social media presence, we are eager to hear from practitioners across the globe about how we can continue making sure that we're elevating our focus on human-centered rehabilitation, but as well as that we're elevating one of our core goals, helping the helpers through practice-led learning. So practice-led learning for us is about hearing from frontline psychologists, counselors, as well as officers, leaders, psychiatrists, forensic psychiatrists, about specifically what is happening in our systems. We want to both generate insights from real-world practice and use those insights to refine programs, to loop back to researchers, and to improve policy and outcomes. One of the things that we know is that evidence-based models work best when they have contextual expertise. I'm thinking about some conversations that I had with my colleagues in Australia and New Zealand, and really talking about examples where, how are we modifying evidence-informed treatment protocols, say in cognitive behavioral health, to make sure that they reflect culturally the values of Indigenous peoples in those communities. That's where we really see that contextual expertise elevating what we know from research and from practice works in evidence-based models. So as I outline these next three core components to our peer-based learning, I want to highlight that we are, again, eager to hear from a global community about how we can do this even greater than we are at this time. We want to make sure that there's continuous learning loops. So for us, that's practice, reflection, adaptation, and evaluation. It also includes looping back to researchers. We want to make sure that there's collaborative design and delivery. One thing that we are aware of is that we can have fantastic collaborations and designs, both on the security side as well as on the clinical side, but we really need to work together. There is not a single psychologist, generally speaking, who never has to interact with security staff and other people working in these justice systems. So we need to figure out how we're implementing our programs and designs together. And then we want to make sure that we're implementing evaluation to understand what's working for whom and under what conditions. Bottom line is this matters deeply for corrections. Correctional environments are very complex. Therefore, our programs must be adaptive, not rigid. And practitioners bring essential knowledge from the field that research alone cannot capture. Practice-led insights ensure that interventions are humane, culturally grounded, and sustainable. The other examples that I want to highlight include making sure that trauma-informed responses and motivational interviewing are moving into existing curricula. Talked earlier about how cognitive behavioral needs to be informed by local cultures and lived experience. But I also want to highlight the use of structured reflection and service feedback to increase engagement and trust. The role of IACP moving forward, really our goal, of course, is to strengthen a global community of psychologists and people working in the front lines, providing behavioral health treatment in prisons, probation, parole, community supervision. We'd like to expand our partnerships globally. We want to promote research that is practical, inclusive, and connected to the daily work, but we also want to elevate that practitioner voice and peer-based learning. One of the highlights for me when I started, when I joined this organization, was being validated in something that I know for me, working as a psychologist in jails and correctional settings, was very real, just feeling very isolated. Sometimes feeling like I was the only psychologist, and I wasn't just feeling that way. Sometimes that was true. Or maybe I had a very small group of behavioral health professionals working in a correctional setting when you have hundreds, if not thousands, of other professionals, security staff, education staff, all of whom are incredibly important. And what IACP has certainly brought to me and many of our members is feeling like there is a sense of community with shared values where we can learn together and then bring those best practice insights to wherever we are working. Again, really grateful to have the opportunity today to talk and to share about IACP. I'll make sure that I get an opportunity to share our website. We're certainly active on LinkedIn and other social media. And I'll also make sure that I drop in our recent bulletin. We do a regular bulletin where we are elevating people in the field. We want to hear from researchers as well as practitioners. And our most recent journal was focused on training and workforce and staff. So we hope you'll have an opportunity to check out those membership options and hear what we're doing. But we also want to hear ideas. How else can we be elevating peer-based learning and global connections to improve both the connection with behavioral health professionals working in correctional settings, but also to help improve the well-being and the support for people working in corrections, also the incarcerated persons and the communities they serve. Thank you for the opportunity to share and would welcome to hear some questions, comments, or any feedback or ideas.
Thanks, Abigail. That was fantastic. A really succinct overview. I think the question that comes up is very, it coincides or corresponds with the aims and objectives of the INCJ network in the sense that I suppose criminal justice settings, prisons, correctional facilities are isolating by their nature. They're about dividing people from society and from community or from the general wider community. And so the importance of having a network that enables you to form that community of practice, that community of ideas, all those kind of things, is incredibly important. How do you benefit from that, in your own work?
Yeah, thank you so much. And I would agree with you. I think well stated is that it can be naturally isolating. I think I think a conversation that actually unfolded while I was in person in Oslo, Norway, with people with colleagues of mine in Europe, in Asia, and having a conversation. We had a conversation about boundaries. It's a really important topic in correctional settings, which is interpersonal boundaries. And, since I started out in this field many, many years ago, where I was trained pretty rigidly around, you have no relationship with incarcerated people, you don't share any personal information, essentially don't be a human to them. Right. Even as a psychologist coming into correctional settings, that's how I was trained. And what we're really seeing from the research as well as programming is that that certainly doesn't mirror society. And so when we have a structure set up like that, we're not setting people best up for rehabilitation. And so there's been efforts to really tackle that. And how are we having conversations around how you can be a human with other human beings who are in a rehabilitative journey and not be so rigid? And while I definitely can see there's certain programming that certainly shows us some support there, I've seen it firsthand myself. I believe in that concept. It also raises the risk of potentially inappropriate boundaries, right? You still have to make sure that we're maintaining our professionalism. So this great conversation, and it was some place where I felt very isolated. I thought I was maybe one of the only psychologists who had ever had to deal with this issue, right? How do you hold staff accountable to professional boundaries, but also maintain that they should be human? And having an in-depth conversation with people across the globe around that, that's a reality in most correctional settings, what's working for some people and what's not. It actually spawned, we're going to be doing sort of a webinar podcast coming up in 2026, because we realized that so many of us need to have this conversation. So that's going to be one of our efforts coming forward. But yeah, I think it's one of those things where it can be isolating. And specifically, we know from psychology that when you're going through something that's challenging and you don't talk about it, it usually doesn't get better. We actually need to connect with other humans to learn and to feel supported and grow.
So you have any questions?
Yeah. Hi, thank you, and Abigail. That was really nice to hear about your work, and it's really interesting. I'm already on your website looking as you're talking. So I have two questions, I think. One is, from my understanding, prisons in Norway are quite small. I think I remember reading a prison ethnography, and the author said, oh, I conducted this field work in the largest prison in Oslo, and it says 250. That's a win in China. We have like a medium-sized prison will be like 3,000 people. So my question is, do you find, and I was just talking to Rob, like I think Nordic prisons are exceptional also, but also often people are not looking at the society in general outside the walls. They are exceptional because their society as a whole are quite exceptional in many different ways. So do you find it still really helpful to compare and learn some infrastructure or some basic social structures or numbers are hugely different? And so that's my...
Yeah.
Should I ask both or... Maybe.
I think I'm following. So let me, and okay. I'll start by an answer, and then you let me know if I got it right, or you can follow up. The first thing I would say is that you're absolutely right. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in prisons in Colorado, in California, and same thing, right? Like that's a wing, right? It's just like, it's a module.
Yeah.
It's just that. So yeah. I also walked away with like, man, this is amazing. This is cool. I don't necessarily know exactly how to translate it over. What I would say is that it was then in the conversations to hear from them how they advocated for that, how they supported that. And to your other point, how it is a reflection of their larger society. So their larger society, their perceptions about criminal justice reform are very different than certainly what I see here in the States. And and that really led to two, I would say, actionable items, to your point, right? I can't just take the Norway model and pop it in, right? It's not relative in that sense, but based on volume and size, right? But number one, it led us, IACFP, to decide that, you know, we need to do more community outreach. We need to be engaging our community. We need to be doing more education around what is rehabilitation, right? And so that really led us to have an actionable item of like, well, we need to be part of the solution. We can't just be sitting here complaining that about this. We need to be part of the solution. So that was one actionable item. And the other thing is that I do know that there were several members at the table, and certainly myself included, who took away some takeaways to say, when you're talking with leaders about, let's just say that they're going to create a new mental health pod, right? We're going to create a new wing. And as a psychologist, I would regularly be advocating for the importance of environmental design, low staff ratios, et cetera, et cetera. It's fantastic to be able to bring a real world example where that's working. Like, hey, certainly you got to cross that cultural divide. But it's really helpful to be able to say, this isn't just research that has no practice. It has practice, but certainly maybe perhaps not in our cultures and studies. So I think that was helpful and to hear their challenges. And they do still have challenges in advocating for what they know is working. And it was helpful to hear that and really be validated. You have to fight for those best practice principles. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, definitely. I think maybe we sometimes forget that there is a journey for them to get there as well. they probably didn't just come out as perfect. Probably it'll be interesting for me to look a bit more on that, because I always thought, oh, they've just got so much like good resources and all that, and that they're automatically good, but probably not. Probably there's a process to that as well. That's great. And links to my second question, actually, slightly diverting from your specialism, but I find it a everlasting question that I always think when I'm teaching students across different countries and contexts, is that, is there a really short, concise, witty answer you give when people ask you, why should we be humane to especially serious offenders? Because, member of public, friends and family, even our undergrad students, I think everyone struggles with that reconciliation between wanting retribution and thinking about rehabilitation.
Yeah, I would offer two things. So first, what I would say is that I have yet to work with an individual who was a serious offender that, when I went back far enough in their history, didn't find a very serious history of trauma, isolation, and terrible, inhumane, and often illegal things happening to them as a human. And so for me, that perspective that when we potentially as a society have failed this individual, and it has resulted in behaviors that we find unacceptable, and they are unacceptable, right? In my world, mental illness and substance use is not an excuse to violate the rights of others. It is informative and it gives us a recovery path, but it is not an excuse to violate the rights of others. But when we've failed in that, how do we start to then move forward? And we know from a ton of research that shame and blame, while it's quick and easy, it's not effective. It doesn't actually help transform humans and individuals. And there's a lot of really good research and practice in multiple settings, not just in rehabilitation, to show that that works. And I think the other thing, too, is that I would say that it's very easy to feel that when you're at a distance. But when you have an opportunity to see people with lived experience live a life of recovery in the community, even people who've been committed of very heinous crimes, I think it can be very transformative. I'm thinking about an organization, the Realness Project, that I work with here in Colorado, and they work to help rehabilitate people, to provide services, like interpersonal services. But one of the gems is that you get to see people, even after incarceration, living lives, contributing back to society, walking on that path. And so it's really hard to judge and others when we are closer to them and their own journeys, which can very much mirror ours sometimes.
Well, there's lots we can follow up with this, and I'm making a list of how we follow up with a lot of these things. So we'll probably maybe organize an in more depth podcast or a joint webinar or something in the future. Yeah. So we've got a taster at the moment. We'll provide the links in the blog post that we post out for this. And we'll put them there, and we'll definitely be keeping in contact. So, Abigail, thank you very much for being up so early. I hope you enjoy. I don't know if you're a coffee head and you're off for your next coffee soon. So it's at mid afternoon here now. So my coffee time has passed. I'm on herbal tea. So thank you very much. We'll speak to you soon.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice. To find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.